history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some pretty amazing stories out there just waiting to be told if we'll simply take a little time to listen. That's what we try to do every time here as we seek to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along that journey, boy, do we learn a lot. We are educated, we're entertained, and often we really are inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today, we're going to learn about a couple of aspects of World War II that we don't hear about all that often. Even on this program, we haven't explored them too frequently. One would be the role of the Merchant Marines. Another, the role of Chinese Americans in World War II. We can do that because our guest belongs to both of those groups. He's also a historian, an author, and I think you'll hear over the next hour that not only is he a gentleman and a scholar, he's a sharp 91-year-old with a keen sense of humor and also a powerful perspective to share with us. Murray Lee of San Diego, California. La Jolla, to be specific. In fact, he lives just down the mountain from my favorite place in San Diego, the Mount Soledad National Veterans Memorial, which we'll hear a little more about later. But let's start, Murray, with your childhood. I'm pretty sure you didn't grow up saying, I'm going to be a historian someday and write a bunch of books.
No, I was born on a farm in Michigan, because in those days when the mothers were ready for birth, they usually went off to their parents' place or something like that. So that's what my mother did. She was living in Detroit, and so that's not far from my grandparents' home, which was near Marshall, Michigan. And so that's where she went when she had her two children, had me, and then about a year and a half later, my brother. So we were both born on that farm. But we lived in Detroit. I can remember my father had a catering store. We were in the store, my brother and I, who was about a year and 4 months younger than me, were playing there, and they had a big radiator along the front wall below the windows there. It was only a couple of feet high, and my brother was walking on that radiator, and he fell behind the radiator, and his head got stuck in there, and it was burning, scarred his cheek, and I yelled to my father to come. Of course, I was too small to get him out of there. He ran up and rescued him, but he had this scar on his cheek forever, as I remember, this burn scar. That was a traumatic sort of situation that I remember. I also remember first and only broken bone that I ever had was because I was walking on the top of a fence and fell off of it. Because, you know, I used to do these kind of stupid things. You walk along the top railing of a fence and I fell and I broke my arm.
And let me ask you, I guess, growing up, did it seem at all unique to you that your father was Chinese and your mother was white? Was that something that even occurred to you, that that was different or unique?
I'm certainly aware of it, but I didn't think about it really. I was pretty much accepted by everybody. But when you move to any new area as a kid, you're challenged by other kids. At that time, there was no Asians at all in Virginia, in Arlington County, and that. And we sort of moved out there, and I went to an elementary school, and I went to the junior high school. In a junior high school, I liked to play sports, so I was in the junior high basketball teams. And there's no way that I could qualify my size, being about 5'8", but they had a basketball team by weight. You had to be under 120 pounds. And so I qualified for that, so I signed up to play that. So we played all the other junior high schools, and we were a pretty good team, so that was kind of fun. Then high school, where I was living, we used to like to play sandlot football. I remember playing football, and I was playing as quarterback on this one team, and I was a pretty good football player. But when I went into high school, the gym teacher knew me from junior high, and he said, I'm not going to allow you to play football here, but you might break a leg or something like that. I wasn't big enough for that. It says, but you can run track. I had done pole vaulting and that, so I went on the track team as a pole vaulter. Then they said, we could use you in the half mile. I said, okay. So while I was pole vaulting, they called you for the half mile. So I went and ran a half mile. When I came back to the pole vaulting, I was so tired that was it. Wherever I was when I left would be the height that they would call me for, because there's no way that you can start pole vaulting immediately after finishing a half-mile race, because you're you're pretty well exalted. But after a little while there, I would do the broad jump. So that was where I got my letter in Washington Lee High School, which was the only high school in Northern Virginia at that time.
Well, let me ask you, something else happened while you were in high school that I'm sure was memorable, and everybody who was alive then seems to remember something about it. December 7th, 1941. Do you remember where you were and how you heard what happened out at Pearl Harbor?
Well, everybody, of course, heard about that. I was working, and everybody knew that they had to go into service as soon as they graduated. And a friend of mine and I said, well, what are our choices? At that time, it was like, well, we're all filled up in the Air Force on these education programs and things like that that we wanted to get into. He says, well, why don't we go and join the Merchant Marine up in Sheepshead Bay, Long Island? So that's where we went. And so when I was up there, I said, well, I'd like to get some special training, so I would like to go to radio school. And they had two radio schools. One was in the harbor there in New York, and another one was in the harbor in Boston. So what they did was, just as soon as I applied and qualified to go, they closed the schools and said, we're filled up. There's only one radio operator on each merchant ship, and we have trained enough now, so we're closing down those schools. I've always seemed to be right behind everything there. And so I said, well, what are my choices? And I said, well, you go into the engine room, or you be a steward, you know, like that's like a busboy and serve meals and things like that, or you go on deck. And I said, I don't want to go in the engine room. I want to know what's going on. If I get out there, there's a torpedo or something. I want to be up where I can see what's going on. So I just said to be on deck. We didn't have any choice. The first ship we was going on, they shipped four of us down to the Norfolk to be on a ship that was looking for people. And I know why they were looking for people, because they couldn't keep them, because this was an old ship built back in like 1916, and it didn't have a bit of paint on it. It was 100% rust. But at that time, that steel that they had was pretty good, so it lasted. So they said, okay, have you ever steered a ship? I said, no. Well, get on this wheel and follow this course. At that time, they didn't have automated, you know, steering. It was a compass, magnetic compass. So they said, follow this course. So I did, and I was very good at it, in the sense that I could see that the ship would drift. It depends upon the tide or the wind in that. And so I would adjust this to this before it did that, so that I could stay on this course. And they were looking, and, you know, they said, you know, wow, this guy can, you know, because to most of the guys that steer, the ship is going like this, winding, you know, because they compensate after it starts to turn. So anyway, when I got to the end of this was up in Boston, we were going to, hauling a load of coal, believe it or not, but it didn't affect the ship since it was all rust anyway. So when I got there, we got paid, and I got more money than these other guys that were with me on a ship, because we made you an acting able-bodied seaman because you were such a good helmsman.
And how old were you at the time?
18.
When you signed up for that, did you have any idea how dangerous that was? Because statistically, being in the Merchant Marines was as dangerous as anything in World War II.
More dangerous. But in 1942, there were more Merchant Marine sailors killed than all other services combined in the Atlantic, because the German U-boats were patrolling the Atlantic, and they weren't encountering any U.S. Navy or anything. At that time, all the efforts of the Navy were in the Pacific. So along the coast, they were sending out patrol boats and private planes and things like that. Even one private plane carried a bomb in and tried to, by hand, to drop it on a U-boat because they could see them, but they couldn't do anything about it because, you know, they were yachts and other kinds of ships along with it. And then Churchill contacted Roosevelt and said, we are an island nation. We are under attack by the Nazis. We cannot survive unless we get your food and supplies. You've got to start sending us stuff. So that's when they started the convoys. So the convoys would go out, and at first the German U-boats would say, well, there's a spot where these convoys don't have air protection out in the middle of the Atlantic. We'll sit there with our wolf packs, they call them, and we'll wait and we'll pick off all these ships because they're not getting support from North America. Well, eventually they closed that gap and they developed radar and sonar. And so then the U-boats came under attack because they could trace it. They even got the code from the German code, so they knew where these guys were going, and then the U-boats were on the run. That was a great turnabout in the Atlantic there.
But were you aware of any of that as a teenager when you signed up?
Well, no. Actually, when I signed up, I was up in the training. The war in Europe had ended. And in fact, I was in Times Square when the Japanese surrendered.
That must have been interesting.
It was, because you know that we have that famous KISS statue here in San Diego. Well, I was there when that was going on. And I remember all these guys doing that. And of course, I was too bashful to go and grab a girl, you know, that I didn't know and kiss her. But I saw all these guys doing that, these Navy guys, and everybody was celebrating that. My friend and I did meet a couple of girls, and they said, oh, you want to go walk into Central Park or something with us? And I said, okay, we'll go and take a look at that. And so that was kind of interesting period, but we were very fortunate that was the end of hostilities, but it wasn't the end of danger, because when we were out in the Atlantic, we had to watch out for floating mines, because it was going up to Antwerp, and that we had a minesweeper going ahead of us. They had me go on a bow one time. They said, why don't you go do lookout on a bow? And I said, look out on a bow? If we had a mine, that's the first place it's going to blow up, right? Well, that's your job. Go do it.
What kind of ship was that you were on? What was the name of it?
That was a Liberty ship. I think it was called the Thomas Sumter. It was one of the last Liberty ships, you know, were built in here in California by Kaiser in 7 days. And they would slap these things together, and you know, you could tell that too but they carried a lot of cargo, and but they were slow. They could only make like 9 knots, so they're always lagging behind, so they're kind of the first thing that gets attacked, you know, these Liberty ships.
So you guys were taking supplies across the Atlantic, and were you bringing some troops home or no?
Well, one of those, not that particular ship, but another ship, which was a Victory ship, was converted to a troop carrier. They took everything down in the hold. They would put these 5-decker bunks in that so they could carry troops instead of cargo. And so when we loaded all these guys' troops on the ship to come back, and some of these guys, they had all their weapons with them. They'd have all these guns lying around. And the other thing that they did, they'd gamble. They had a lot of pay, you know, that they got from, you know, they'd be on the top of the cargo hold gambling. And I figured that probably by the time they got to America, there would be 1 out of 10 of those that have all the money and all the others, because there were some sharpshooters on board there. None of them wanted to go down in the hold to sleep. They said, if you won't go down there, there's going to be somebody that's going to throw up there, and it's going to smell like terrible. And so we'd rather come up on sleep on deck, and that's what they did. They did not want to go down there and sleep, and I could see why they didn't want to, because go down there and sleep in a 5-decker bunk, you know, and all with all these guys. And they were not seaworthy, so all you do is you roll a little bit, and pretty soon they're all sick. And one gets sick, they all get sick.
And I didn't want to cut you off there, interrupt. I think that was an important point you made, that hostilities were over, but the danger wasn't. Were there some times where you look back on and you say, hey, we came pretty close to that, or that was a little more treacherous than I hoped it would be?
Yeah, on that one ship, there were a lot of very rough seas. I remember approaching the, you don't realize how stormy it is around the English Channel and that, and close to that. So it was all these rough waters, and you saw, well, you had these patrol boats coming out there doing minesweeping and that. And he said, well, that's the main danger. There's a lot of loose mines around, and you can't always rely on these sweepers. And that's when I said, when I was on deck and these minesweepers were in front of me, I said, well, go be lookout on the bow. And I said, well, that's the worst place to be. When we got into the harbor, we had to wait for a while they had a channel going in there, and they had these locks. They'd have to wait to you to go in there, so they had you stand by there, and we did in this harbor right in front of Antwerp. And a storm came up suddenly and blew us up on a bank, and you went to and looked down off the ship, and you saw all this sand, you know. I said, wow, we're stuck on this side here. I said, what else can happen to this ship? And so they had to wait till high tide, and they sent these tugboats out and dragged it off the bank, and then we went up into the harbor. They sent a diver down to see if any damage had been done to the hold, you know, punctured or anything like that, because we had to go all the way back, you know. They didn't find anything, because we went up and it was sand, I think, at that spot rather than rocks, and so that worked out. And then that ship made it all the way back to the U.S. and went right straight down to Norfolk, Virginia, where they had a place where all the ships were anchored. It's a graveyard, I guess, because they had too many ships and they didn't need all of these. And that ship was already ready for burial. Everything that happened to it, because we were adrift for 4 days in the Atlantic, and they tried to tow us, and the tow rope broke because we had this huge, huge cargo of sugar, and that was so heavy. This one ship that tried to tow us got started, and tow rope snapped. If you're anywhere on deck when that tow rope snaps, you better watch out, because that thing whips around and can take your legs right off. But anyway, somebody was smart enough to know, say, hey, we got this whole cargo of sugar. Let's burn it to get the boilers going. So that's what they did. They burned our sugar. So sugar does burn, fortunately. So that was some of the more interesting things.
Were there moments in there where you were frightened, where you're thinking, I don't know if this was the best idea, and I don't know if I'm going to get back and see my family again?
Well, that's possible. I didn't tend to try to think about that. One trip down in Argentina, and as you remember, a lot of the high-level Nazis escaped, and they went to Argentina, took different names and things like that. I remember when we went off the ship in Argentina, we were walking to shore to Buenos Aires. There was this guard that stopped us, and he looked like a Gestapo guy. He had his black, you know, boots and all that sort of stuff like that, because they had a lot of Germans down there. And anyway, he wanted to examine us. He checked all our pockets and everything, and I had a small knife in my pocket, which every seaman has, because, you know, it's an emergency. You need to cut a rope or something like that. And he took that. So I said, well, what am I going to do? That was a welcome to Buenos Aires.
You're just speculating that he was one of those escaped Nazis, or did that seem pretty clear to you?
He evidently was kind of like a sympathizer. I don't think he was a German, but was not a welcome. I mean, here we're delivering stuff to them. It's not like we are enemy ship or something like that. We're bringing cargo to you.
So how long did you end up staying in the Merchant Marines?
2 years. Truman wrote something, which I have a copy of, to me and to all the merchant seamen, saying, we are very thankful for your service in the Merchant Marine. We figure that you have served your 2 years requirement, and you are exempt, you know, from being drafted. Because a lot of the people in Congress said, well, these guys never served in the military. It's like the Merchant Marine was not part of our war effort. You're going to have to sign up for a draft. And I remember going down to somewhere in Virginia where they were doing recruiting, signing people up. And I went down there, and everybody was to take a test. So I did this, and I finished it and turned it in. They called me up to where the officers were and said, what are you trying to do? Are you trying to purposely flunk this test so that you don't qualify for service? And I said, no, I don't think so. I said, well, you hardly got any questions right. I said, well, I thought the test was very easy. Maybe I didn't miss anyone. In fact, I was helping one of the other guys there, because a lot of those guys were there, couldn't read, and I was reading the questions to them and that. And the other guy that was up there said, yeah, he did do that. Then they came back and he said, oh, we're so sorry. We had 2 exams, you know. We used the wrong one to grade yours. You really did get almost all the questions right. We apologize to you for this. I said, well, I thought, these guys, I said, I don't want to be in this. So they said, well, we have a place for you. And they started to be real nice, you know, and totally changed their whole attitude. I ended up actually, I was married at the time, and we had our first child and that. And so I eventually became exempt. And it wasn't until 1980-something that they granted Merchant Marine veteran status. But then all the veterans' benefits are gone.
So someone who served in the Army or the Navy or the Marines or the Army Air Corps or the Coast Guard, they could go to college and use the GI Bill. But even though you were risking your life, you didn't have that.
I had to work my way through school. I worked nights and weekends in my father's restaurant. Of course, I was going to George Washington University, and they had night classes and weekend classes, so I was taking all these classes. We had a first son, so I hardly saw him for that year, because I was working nights and weekends and everything, and finally graduated. I did earn Phi Beta Kappa. According to the head of the geography department, I was probably the first one of their students that got Phi Beta Kappa.
And that would lay the foundation for the extensive research and writing he's done since. You can check out some of the books he's written and order them if you want at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And his story has quite a few more twists and turns to take. Back with more from Murray Lee of San Diego. Diego, California, when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Put $250 in a savings account and you'll start earning dividends. Who else is going to do that for you? And access? So easy. Over 30,000 ATMs. Free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Again, the website myeecu.org, or just pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation today with World War II merchant marine veteran turned historian with a specialty in Chinese American history, Murray Lee. He's 91 years old. He's got quite the life story, and we're not even going to hear all of it here. Some things you may just have to ask him in person sometime, maybe at the Chinese Historical Museum in San Diego, which he's been a part of since its founding. Have you ever encountered people who, when you wear a merchant marine hat or tell them you were in the merchant marines, they have no idea what you're talking about?
Yes, that's true, of course. The uniform that we had when it was the Maritime Service was the training organization for the merchant marine. It was up in Sheepshead Bay, and I think they had another one down in Florida, and maybe there was one over here on the West Coast. But we had a uniform. It's like a Navy uniform, but it's different. And then on one trip that I had, my folks moved from Arlington to Alexandria. When I went back, I said, well, where's my uniform? And my brother was, of course, in the same bedroom as I was, and they threw it away, I guess. You can't believe it. That's a very unique uniform. You can't even see or find one of these like this. It was very similar to Navy, but it was different. We have uniform-wearing days at our church, you know, periodically, and you're supposed to put on what you wore, you know, when you were in your service. And I said, oh, my gosh, I sure wish I had that uniform.
Well, you don't have the uniform, no. But you do have a letter from the President of the United States. It says, to you who answered the call of your country and served in its merchant marine to bring about the total defeat of the enemy, I extend the heartfelt thanks of the nation. You undertook a most severe task, one which called for courage and fortitude, because you demonstrated the resourcefulness and calm judgment necessary to carry out that task. We now look to you for leadership and example in further serving our country in peace. Signed, Harry Truman, on the White House letterhead. That's a nice letter, but you had to wait another 40 years to get veterans benefits, huh?
What happened was Congress reneged on that pledge there. They just decided that, no, we're not going to follow through on this. And so they started drafting veterans from the Merchant Marine. I know I had some friends that were in there, and they got drafted after spending 2 years and maybe even more than 2 years in Merchant Marine. They got drafted into the Army and had to spend 4 more years. And that's about a 6-year contribution to, you know, that. And by the time they got out, you know, they had to go look for jobs or try to go to school there, you know, later on. And it sort of put them in a setback. Quite a bit. I was fortunate enough to be exempt because I got married and then had a child and got through that way.
What was it that got you interested in history, that set you on the path of becoming a historian and author and educating people about the things you cared about?
Well, I guess it's because hardly anybody was doing that, recording their history. And if you don't start doing it early on, either keeping a diary or, you know, recording your experiences of that, you usually later on can't remember it and you get too busy working or something like that to do anything about it. So I had some notes and things that I had written about various experiences, and I started to write some of this down because I said, well, I won't be able to remember this a few years from now. So, and then working for, my degree, and I didn't get the GI Bill, so I was working nights and weekends and that to pay my way through school. I did some writing for that class that I was taking. It was a class in geography. I wrote about the geographic factors in the Washington area for vacations in the Chesapeake Bay and the ocean. When I wrote about the Chesapeake Bay, he said, "Oh, the ocean is much better than the Chesapeake Bay." But I said, the Chesapeake Bay was very convenient to Washington. It was before they built the Bay Bridge, so it was very hard to get to the ocean. So a lot of people went to Chesapeake Bay. And I said, it had its advantages. The water was warmer, and they had the best crabs that you could find anywhere. These blue crabs were, really delicious, and you could catch those by just dangling pieces of chicken and things off of a dock, and the crabs would come up, and then you'd scoop them up under a net. Anyway, that's when I started writing some things. I ran out of time to, I was working on a master's thesis and working, and then I went overseas on assignment, and the 7 years that you're allowed to get your thesis done had run out. So I had 27 credits out of 30.
And I'll jump in here for a moment. You said you had to go overseas on assignment, and I'm sure a lot of people are out there listening and thinking, well, what kind of assignment? And unfortunately, we can't get too specific on that, but it was a government assignment. You became very skilled in cartographic research and producing maps and atlases. You ended up with decades of professional experience in that field, but time ran out on your master's degree until you published a book and you let your alma mater know about it, and that led to your finishing that thesis and receiving your master's just in recent years when you were well into your 80s. But I'd like to know, what was it that led you to write that book? Because I know you've been a curator at the Chinese Historical Museum in San Diego since it opened back in the mid-90s, but what made you want to write this book, In Search of Gold Mountain, that has led to other books and projects, including one you're still working on now?
There was no history been written about the Chinese in San Diego, for one, and not too much about it in the whole country. The history of the Chinese in each city is fairly similar, so if you write one, do research for, like, San Diego, it's going to compare with what Chinatowns were like in different parts of the country, because most of the people were actually from the same parts of China, and so they have the same traditions and the same organizations and things. So if I wrote about San Diego, the first chapter would be about immigration and exclusion. I wrote that quite some number of years ago when I was a member of the Chinese Historical Society of San Diego. She said, "Oh, we can't publish that because it's too negative." And I said, "Well, the history is negative. That's the whole problem. You've got to tell people." He said, "But you're talking about people who are here on false papers and things." I said, "But that was the history. I mean, they're not going to send them back to China now." But he says, "Well, we won't publish it." And I said, "Well, what can I do?" When I started to write this book, I said, "I am going to put that as the first chapter in my book. That's basic to everything." And then I started to research the history of the Chinese here in San Diego, and I had to interview people who lived in Chinatown. I prioritized them based on their age and their physical conditions and things like that. I said, "I must interview these people while they're still alive in that, because they've got history that will be totally lost if we don't." I also went to all the libraries and dug up all the books that I could find, and I had a lot of cooperation with San Diego History Center down in Balboa Park, because they knew what I was doing, and the person down there in charge of the research and that would dig up stuff for me and say, "Oh, this would be very useful to you, because this is a story of what happened to the Chinese, say, in the 1920s or something like that here in San Diego." And I said, "Oh, great." And then I discovered these papers. When anybody died, they had to have a document why and what happened to them. And so they had all these handwritten copies of coroner's reports. They would interview people that knew this person that died, these Chinese that died. And you found out a lot about the history of the Chinese that lived here, because these people that were being interviewed would tell their stories. I spent a lot of time copying all those, putting them in my book, because there's information of that that you would never run across otherwise.
Well, I imagine a lot of this book is stuff that most people wouldn't run across, most people don't know, and most people wouldn't imagine. I know you can't tell us the entire contents of the book here, and maybe some people will be motivated to buy it, but what are some of the things that you were surprised to learn or that opened your eyes in the process of putting that book together?
The experiences that these people had that lived in Chinatown, and how they adapted to the situation of being restricted to a certain part of the city and never being allowed to go, say, Market Street was kind of the boundary. You couldn't go north of Market Street. You were restricted to Livingston, and how they adjusted to that.
And some people are hearing that right now and say, wait a second, I've never heard of anything like this. People were treated that way. Explain to me what some of those laws were and what it meant to be a Chinese immigrant during those time periods.
Well, you have the Chinese exclusion laws. That's not just one law. It was a period of several laws. I mean, over the years, they got worse and worse. They would renew those, and they kept doing it for quite a number of years. So I would say there's probably 10 laws that apply to, you know, except for one exclusion laws. And they got worse and worse, and then they started to include not just Chinese, but to include all Asians. And it wasn't until 1943, World War II, the Japanese can use this as propaganda, saying, hey, you know, you're excluding all Asians in your country. We want to include them in our greater prosperity here in Asia, you know. And so they used that as a weapon against that. So we repealed the exclusion laws in 43, I guess it was.
And when you say Japanese, I want to be clear. You're talking about Imperial Japan said, we're going to use this against America and try to get people to sympathize with us.
That's right. And that was a pretty good case made, so that they immediately repealed the exclusion laws. That didn't mean that there still weren't problems, because they had a lot of Chinese that in these exclusion laws that had gone back to China. I think there was like 20,000 Chinese at one time that had gone back to visit their relatives, and they never allowed to come back because they had left the country. So there were issues that kept going on for quite some time.
And had you been aware of that before you started studying this, or was this all news to you?
Yes, I was aware of it, but not in any detail. Like, start looking into it and start reading some of the stuff. It can't believe it all happened. And I didn't experience that much back when I was going to school in Washington, D.C. in that. Although I think my father was aware of that, and he came to Washington because it was a place where they could work and have a good income in that. But he encountered it in a different way. They had miscegenation laws in Virginia, and they had those throughout the South. And we know that there was a Filipino sailor down in Norfolk that tried to marry a white woman, and it was not allowed. In the case of my father, who married my mother, who was Caucasian, they were married up in, say, Ohio and that, and there were no miscegenation laws in the North there. But I know that in Virginia they had that. In fact, in California had this too.
I think people can read between the lines, but spell it out for me. What does that kind of law mean? What is it prohibiting?
Prohibiting the marriage of whites and blacks, or whites and Asians. They threw Asians in the category of being, you know, non-whites. So I know Virginia had that, and when my wife and I got married, we said, well, you know, I'm Chinese and American. On my mother's side, it's Caucasian, and that my birth certificate says that I am white because I was born up in Michigan. Up there, it was just you're either black or white, you know. They didn't have any other categories.
And your mother's white, so a white woman is giving birth, the baby's white.
So anyway, my wife and I decided, well, it says that I'm white, and if I marry a Chinese woman, maybe we'll have problems with that. So what we did is, we said, well, let's not get married in Virginia. Let's go across the river to Maryland and get married, which we did. I don't know if it would have been challenged, but we said we didn't want to have to bother with it.
Well, it kind of underscores the insanity of it, doesn't it? That someone who's half Chinese would be barred from marrying a Chinese wife. It's hard for anybody to imagine that today, that those laws even existed, but they did. And as you said, blacks and Japanese Americans and Chinese Americans dealt with that here in California. And California wouldn't be the California we know without the influence of Chinese immigrants. How would you encapsulate the impact that Chinese immigrants have had on California?
Well, of course, it starts out with building the Transcontinental Railroad. The guys that were in charge of building that realized that, you know, we can't build a railroad here without the aid of Chinese workers and that. They did all they could do to bring in the workers and that, but then you had a lot of people against that. I know when they built the railroads down here in San Diego and in Arizona, and, you know, connected to a railroad through Mexico on into Arizona and that, they said, well, you know, you can't build a railroad anywhere these days in this country without using Chinese labor, because nobody else wants to do this kind of work. That's true also in other fields. That's when Spreckles was here building a railroad and building the Coronado Hotel and other things like that. And that's pretty much what he said. Chinese labor is necessary to do this kind of work.
And you mentioned the Hotel del Coronado, which is one of San Diego's most famous landmarks. And you told me that if you go inside that historic building, you can see the telltale signs of Chinese handiwork?
Well, yeah, the one main ballroom in there, you look at the ceilings and you'll see that there's no nails and no anything in there. And it's all woodwork that's done by Chinese labor. Not only did they work on the hotel itself, but they helped early on in Coronado in clearing the land and building a pier. And there were a lot of Chinese that came down from San Francisco at one time. They worked on Coronado. And they worked actually with labor from Mexico and Black and all together, and they all got along very well. It's just those people who don't believe in any kind of integration like that of races and protesters, things like that. But the workers did get along well in the clearing the land on Coronado.
So these Chinese immigrants were integral in the growth of California, the infrastructure that still remains. But despite that, they did face discrimination. What to you is the most jarring or troubling reality when you look back at how some of these Chinese immigrants were treated?
Well, I think it had to do with getting jobs and the marriage situation. The attitude of the people here, like even in San Diego, where they wanted to drive the Chinese fishermen out of the country by passing laws which say if you go outside the 3-mile limit, you have left the country, and when you come back, produce your papers. Obviously, they didn't have papers, so when they came back, and they had built all these ships, Chinese ships, junks and things in San Diego. When they came back from fishing or gathering abalone and that, they'd gone out beyond the 3-mile limit. They had to sell their junks or give them up or go back to China and that. And that's kind of destroying their livelihood. But that was the attitude, you see, of the people here at this time. He says, you take away their living here, that will drive them back home. And there were only a very few people in San Diego that kind of recognized. And one of them was George Marston. His mother had a Chinese cook, and they had a lot of encounters with the Chinese. And they said, they're very reliable people, and we don't believe in excluding them. But they were in a minority.
And what about your own family's history? Because you have another book that you've written called Elephant and the Indians. My grandfather, the elephant, a Chinese railroad worker captured by Indians. Is that fiction or is that nonfiction?
I would say it's the fact is it's true that he was captured by Indians, lived with them for 2 years, was adopted by the Indian chief, and eventually went to Baltimore, accompanied by a gambler after 2 years. All that's true. What I had to write was, well, what was his life like in those 2 years? Because there's no record of that. He didn't keep a diary. Nobody knew exactly what it was. But I did a lot of research on the Indians and the railroads at that time. They worked on the whole situation up there in the Pacific Northwest. I figured that I would tell this story because my grandfather survived. He was captured because the workers were working in an area cutting through the Indian lands there. They captured him, whereas some of the other workers got away. But the fact that my grandfather, he fought them. He called the elephant by his fellow workers because he was a big guy. He was over 6 foot tall and very large and strong. He fought off these guys. And in my story, I got the Indians were said, we need to save this guy and take him back to the chief because he's such a good fighter. So that was how we got there. The Indian chief had lost his own son, so he adopted my grandfather.
And if your grandfather hadn't survived that, you would have never been born. There's a link to that book about Murray's grandfather at hometownheroesradio.com, as well as the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. When we come back, we'll talk about his book exploring the contributions of Chinese American veterans. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHSmaster.com Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes. You hear a lot about World War II if you listen to Hometown Heroes, but have you ever wondered what it's like to be on a real World War II ship? The SS Jeremiah O'Brien, one of just two remaining operable Liberty ships, is docked at Pier 45 in San Francisco's famous Fisherman's Wharf. And the O'Brien is offering overnight programs on Fridays and Saturdays for kids ages 6 and up. Kids get to sleep on the ship in World War II bunks, have a private tour of the ship's galley, the crew quarters, guns and gun mounts, exhibits, and the crown jewel, the O'Brien's triple expansion steam engine. This is an experience like no other. For more details, call the SS Jeremiah O'Brien's office at 415-544-0100. That's 415-544-0100. Or visit the ship's website at ssjeremiahobrien.org.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today is Murray Lee, a 91-year-old World War II veteran who served in the Merchant Marines. Nearly a quarter million Americans served in the Merchant Marines, and nearly 10,000 of them were killed. One out of every 26 men in the Merchant Marines never came home. That's the highest ratio of any branch of service in World War II. Murray was also one of approximately 20,000 Chinese Americans who served in our armed forces during the war, and he has captured individual stories of Chinese American vets in his book, Through the Eyes of Heroes, which you can link to at hometownheroesradio.com. What have you learned, Murray, about the contribution of Chinese Americans in World War II?
I know that researching, interviewing a lot of the Chinese Americans here in San Diego, I ran across quite a number of them that had been sent to China, Western China, where Chiang Kai-shek was still in operation in that area. They went to support the Flying Tigers in that area, those areas. They didn't just end up in Kunming or in one city because they wanted to make it difficult for the Japanese to locate these forces where they were, so they went around to various small towns in that area and established a base, you know, kind of scattered around. So they weren't all together, although at one time, then when they left, they all sort of ended up coming all together, and when they were sent back to the U.S., they gathered up in one area, and they, some of them said, oh, you have the opportunity, this is when the war was over there, of going down and visiting your home villages back in Canton, Guangdong area, or you can go straight back to the West Coast in the U.S., and some of them decided to take advantage of that and go and visit their home villages and that.
And even in your own family, you had a couple half-brothers who were doing interesting things during World War II.
They were the first Chinese after Pearl Harbor. They're written up in the newspaper, and there's a picture of them. They were in New York at that time. They joined right after Pearl Harbor. They ended up in the U.S. Air Force. One brother, the older one, went to Europe and was based in England and flew with medium bombers 50 missions over enemy territory in France and Germany. When he came back after those 50 missions, and I just can't believe this, because if you have 50 missions and you don't get wounded, you ought to quit. Because that was required. He went and joined the RAF and flew in their medium bombers, which were wooden bombers at that time. Everybody thought, well, you're crazy. But anyway, he did that. He loved flying, I guess. And the other brother was flying the hump. We supported Chiang Kai-shek and the troops in Kunming and those areas by bringing in supplies from India. They had to go over the Himalayas. That was nothing easy because these two-engine planes, some of them had a lot of trouble. So he was flying back from China to go back to India to get more supplies than that. The engine faltered on this plane, and they all bailed out, and they bailed out over Burma. The pilot just kept the plane going, sacrificed his life so that everybody got out, and he crashed with the plane, so he was the only casualty out of that, but quite a hero in himself. So they landed in this headhunter country in Burma with a tribe that normally probably they would have lost their heads. But this tribe hated the Japanese because the Japanese were invading Burma from the south. And so they said, well, we will walk you guys back through the jungle to India, which was quite a number of days. And so my brother was on that, and they reported that he had a sprained ankle. A lot of them, some of them had more serious injuries, but he is mentioned by Eric Severide, was on that plane, famous correspondent, war correspondent. And so I have this story, and he wrote this all up in the Reader's Digest, and I thought it's a very interesting story. About that. And so they did make it back to India, and where they would be able to continue on and get other planes and get back to flying the hump again. So that's his story.
Well, and in this book, Through the Eyes of Heroes, you have many more Chinese-American veterans who you have interviewed and gotten their story. Some of them are no longer with us. Do you think that the general public has a sense of the contributions of Chinese Americans during World War II?
No, I don't. Maybe even some of the Chinese don't. But that was the whole purpose of this, is to get these interviews of Chinese Americans. They were in various units, from Navy to Marines to Army and all of those. Some of them knew each other. Others may not have, but they all were based here in San Diego, and we had quite a number of Chinese Americans that joined. And a lot of them, when the war was declared, they were in San Diego High School, and all the Chinese that lived in Chinatown went to San Diego High School. That was the only high school, I think, in the area. A lot of them just immediately signed up. But anyway, accumulating all their stories was a major contribution, I think, to the history of Chinese in San Diego.
Well, and I know it's probably hard to pick just one, but is there one story that you came across in putting this book together that just raises your eyebrows or says, wow, that is a hero? I mean, you call it Through the Eyes of Heroes. Who's a hero in this book in your mind?
One of them that I did interview, and that's Gorman Fong. I think that his family's going to have his plaque put up on Mount Soledad, hopefully very soon. I encouraged all of them to do that, and I think one of his sons said, well, I'm going to get it and put it up there. I interviewed him. He had a very interesting story about how he was with this field artillery battalion in 1944. The one big thing that happened to him was in the Battle of the Bulge. Well, Hitler would just told him, go in there, we might lose this war, but we want to drive these guys back to the ocean. They got all their panzer divisions, and they started going back to force all these Americans and British back to where they landed, you know. He was stationed in one place which was right on the route where they were going to be going through. And so he said, well, they considered him a sacrifice unit there. What's that famous correspondent mentioned about him, that they figured that they were gone? Ernie Pyle wrote in the Stars and Stripes that we were already dead, in other words, presumed dead, because we were our sacrifice battery. We saw the colonel and his assistant sitting in their jeep, ready to pull out on the highway, and we were seeing all these foot soldiers marching back carrying their guns. We hear all the rumbling sound of tanks only about a half mile away. We hear these sounds. It was at night. We asked some of those soldiers, hey guys, what's up there? They answered, the Germans are coming right at us. We have a few guns holding them back right now, and you guys will be the last line of defense. Then our marching orders were given to us that could not leave until 0100. By then, the Germans had overrun the position we were in. So that's why we were presumed that we were already dead. We just had the two big guns, 155 howitzers to cover, and 50 caliber machine guns, one on each side of the road. Everybody is going crazy. Nobody wanted to die. They might wonder why we were designated to hold, but our gun positions just happened to be each side of the road. We were just happy to get out alive. So the German panzers were so fast, they just bypassed him. They didn't want to bother with him. And afterwards, he ended up going to Berlin after, we had won that war. He was in Berlin. One of his fellow Americans who was examining a German Luger automatic pistol, while he was doing that, the gun went off and shot Gorman in the leg. And I told Gorman, I said, did you get the Purple Heart for that? He said, no, I didn't get the Purple. I said, yeah, but you were wounded by a German gun, weren't you? I said, you should have gotten a Purple Heart. And there were Chinese in North Africa and in Italy and other places. We have one Chinese in here. His name was Victor Schoon, S-C-H-O-O-N. They never allowed Chinese to fly. They couldn't be pilots. That's a discrimination that they had. They always be tail gunners or something like that. But he ended up being captain of a B-17, flying 50 missions out of Italy. And how did he get that? Because they thought he was German. He had his name Schoen, S-C-H-O-O-N, and that was a name given to his father when he came into the country. They would come in and the immigration officer would say, "Oh, I can't pronounce your Chinese name. I'm just going to call you Schoen." This guy was German, I think, and so they thought he was German, so he became a pilot. And once he became a pilot, they couldn't do much about it. But later on, after he came out of the military, he and his wife were trying to go to a military function in this country, and they wouldn't let him go in. Here this guy was flying 50 missions as a B-17 pilot, and then he goes to an event there, and they look at him and say, "Oh, you and your wife are Chinese. You know, you can't come in here."
I guess I need to ask you, too. You know, and we've talked to so many Japanese Americans on this program who certainly faced discrimination, were locked behind barbed wire during this period. But I've heard stories of Chinese Americans being mistaken for Japanese and treated accordingly, given what was happening at the time. Did you run across any anecdotes like that?
Yes. A number of people said, "Oh, you know, when all this happened, we were walking around the streets and that, and we would wear these little notes on our jacket, you know, 'I am Chinese,' because a lot of people can't tell the difference between Chinese and Japanese. They saw any Asian walking around might be Japanese, and if they saw you and thought you were Japanese, they might beat you up in that." But the Chinese and Japanese did live in an area together before the war. There was a part of San Diego's Chinatown, they called it Fifth and Island, were the same as Japantown. A lot of the Chinese knew the Japanese. In fact, they used to trade stuff together and got along fairly well. And when they interned all these Japanese, some of the Chinese would maybe took over some of those businesses and say, we'll run this place while you're gone, and maybe when you come back, you can take it back." But they did go around with notes on there afterwards when people would look at them and think they were Japanese.
And there's this effort to secure the Congressional Gold Medal. Now, that's happened for Japanese Americans. It's happened for female pilots. It's happened for African American servicemen in World War II. A lot of these different groups have received that Congressional Gold Medal. If it were to be awarded to Chinese American veterans of World War II, which would include you, what would that mean to you?
Well, it would be quite an honor, I think. It's not like any of these guys have not gotten medals, but that's quite a medal, I think. This medal is one of the top of the, and it's nice to get it if you're alive and with it.
So don't wait too long, Congress, right?
Because, you know, there's just not many left.
Well, if there's anything else that you want to share, feel free. And I want to say thank you for serving our country, and thank you for all your efforts in preserving history here. Is there something you would say that you want people who read these books to understand, that there's a message you want to convey or communicate that you hope people will hold on to?
Well, I think that after so many years of discrimination, exclusion, and that to show that the Chinese Americans are Americans, as well as having Chinese ancestry, that they're Americans and that they are willing to fight for their country and to defend it.
And I get the sense, and correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think you've recorded these stories and put them in print just to bemoan the past. I have the sense you see a value in telling these stories to inform the future and make sure that injustices like this never take place again?
Of course, yes. I think the more that people know about what the contribution of the Chinese made to the building of this country and fighting during the war and that is an example of we're a part of America.
I got one more question. I know you're looking forward, not back. You're working on another book right now. But at 91 years old, is there something that you would say you're most proud of or most thankful for?
That I'm still alive. I have a plaque up at Mount Soledad, and I'm very proud that I got that up there because I'm one of the first Chinese in this group here to get one up there, and I've been encouraging others, you should do that. We should have a little section up there where there are Chinese-American war vets because there weren't any before I had mine put up there.
And you can find a picture of Murray next to that plaque he's talking about at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. All the books are linked there as well. The Mount Soledad National Veterans Memorial is an amazing spot with spectacular views in every direction. You could really spend an entire day there soaking in those views and digesting the contributions of the men and women whose military service is honored there. I try to visit every time I'm in San Diego, and I have a link to the memorial online for you as well, but we're out of time today. Thanks to Murray Lee for sharing his unique journey with us today, and thank you for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional too.
I tell you, that honor flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they're going to your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.